I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to race, white is a color too. Debbie Irving's realization of this led her to explore and write about the role that white privilege played in her life. Today, we'll ask the author to share insights that could help other people understand this country's systemic racism and why getting past our discomfort and talking about it is the first step to moving beyond it. Then, in this age of mobility and technology, loneliness is increasing. We'll learn how isolation affects our work performance and our life expectancy. Later, the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. We are a lonely nation, so lonely that 40% of Americans report that they feel lonely at any given time. That sense of loneliness shouldn't be easily dismissed. Our guest today says that loneliness by itself underlies some of the most critical public health issues facing America today. In fact, loneliness can shorten a person's lifespan the same way that obesity or smoking can. It can also disrupt our ability to think and our immune systems. The loneliness epidemic is our topic. Joining us is Dr. Vivek Murthy. He's this country's former Surgeon General who served under President Barack Obama. Doctor, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
It's so great to be with you today, Steve.
Well, help me here. Loneliness can undermine my ability to think or even my immune system? I mean, really?
Well, this is one of the facts that people find surprising, but it turns out it's true and it's grounded in science. We haven't talked about loneliness much as a public health issue as a country, or really as a planet. But the truth is, the more you look at the science, you recognize that there is a strong connection between loneliness and mortality rates and our longevity. There's a connection between loneliness and many of the chronic illnesses that we're worried about, so much so that loneliness is, in fact, associated with a reduction in lifespan. That's the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and it's, in fact, even greater than the impact of obesity. We also know now that loneliness...
That's amazing what you just said. Absolutely amazing.
It is, because we don't think about loneliness as a condition that's as serious as diabetes or heart disease or cancer. But the truth is that it has profound consequences for our health. It is associated with a greater risk of anxiety and depression and heart disease, as well as dementia. So the more we understand about loneliness, the more we recognize two things. One, that far more people experience it than we realize. And the second is we realize the profound consequences, not just for health, but also for education and for how we perform in the workplace.
You know, how have rates of self-reported loneliness changed in recent American history? What are you seeing out there?
Well, over time, and I must say that we don't have hundreds of years of data on this, because this isn't something that we tracked or paid attention to nearly as much as other public health issues. But looking at data from Gallup and from other polls, it does appear that there has been an increase in loneliness over the last several decades in the United States, even though we are now living in the most technologically connected age in the history of civilization. And there's a assumption that many people make that because we have social media, because we have the ability to text and to FaceTime with each other, we should be more connected than ever before.
That was my next question. Lonely. Absolutely.
But it turns out that what matters is not the quantity of connections, but the quality of your connections. And one of my concerns has been that many of our offline connections, our in-person interactions, have become displaced, in some cases, by lower quality online connections. Having thousands of friends on Facebook, for example, is not necessarily the same as having a few close friends that you can rely on, who you can see, who you can talk to, and who you can call when you have great challenges.
So face-to-face interaction comes with a premium. It helps a whole lot more than anything you can do online.
Well, face-to-face interaction certainly is incredibly valuable. That doesn't mean that if you have a close friend who lives in another city who you can't see every day, that you can't have meaningful interaction with them. Phone calls, video calls, these can all be powerful ways of connecting with people. But again, it's the quality of the connection that matters. And what really matters is are these relationships where you feel truly known and seen by the other person, where you can be open and vulnerable, where you can talk about not just your successes and your aspirations and dreams, but also your challenges and your difficulties. It's those relationships that we find are the most powerful and healing, whether they're in person or whether they're across a great distance.
So as a former Surgeon General for this country, loneliness has become a public health issue then. Why?
It's become a public health issue for several reasons. One is because if we look at what has happened to our world over time, we recognize that technology has displaced, in some cases, our higher quality in-person interactions. But if you also look at work has creeped into more and more dimensions of people's lives. So it's crept into the weekends, into evenings, into even vacation time, such that it's even crowding out the quality time that many people have had traditionally with their family and their close friends. And over time, people have also become more mobile. So more and more people are leaving the communities they grew up in and are often moving several times over the course of their life, leaving known trusted communities behind. And all of these have combined to make loneliness more and more prevalent. I started seeing this actually long before I was serving as Surgeon General of the United States. When I was practicing medicine, the most common pathology that I saw was not heart disease or cancer or diabetes. It was, in fact, loneliness. And this was confirmed when I served as Surgeon General and visited communities all across the country and sat down with mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and business owners and doctors and pastors and had conversations. And I found that for so many people, loneliness was an issue that they were experiencing, but they wouldn't say it openly. They would often whisper it to me, or they would say it when we were talking one-on-one. And this points to one other issue that's worth recognizing, that there is an unfortunate stigma around loneliness. And I say that from personal experience. As a child, I was very lonely. When in elementary school, I remember being painfully shy and having a difficult time making friends with other kids. And while I had incredibly loving parents and an incredibly loving sister at home, and I felt quite good there, when I left home, I felt lonely. But you know what? I never told my parents to this day. And the reason I didn't when I was a child is I was ashamed. I felt that if I admitted I was lonely, that was admitting that I was not worthy of being loved.
Yes, yes. And people across the planet still feel that way today, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. They feel that way all the time. I had a middle-aged gentleman who came up to me at an event I did recently, and he said, my best friend died a couple of years ago, and I've felt profoundly alone ever since then. But as a man, I don't feel like I can say that. And I feel like it is somehow emasculating or makes me appear to be weak. But this is real, and I'm experiencing this. What do I do? So this is a common feeling that people have. And traditionally, we thought of loneliness as a problem that affected the elderly. We thought when people get older and their friends and family pass away or move away and they're living alone, that they feel lonely. That is true, but we have now seen very clearly that loneliness is affecting people across the age spectrum, including young people in our schools and universities.
So part of your purpose in talking on this show and others is to begin to deal with this stigma that is so grossly misplaced, you're saying.
That's true, absolutely. I want people to know that if you are feeling lonely, you are absolutely not the only one. And if you are not feeling lonely, it's important that you know that there are likely people around you who are, in fact, feeling alone. And you can have a powerful impact on addressing their loneliness. And that's the beautiful thing about addressing loneliness, is that you don't need a medical degree to be able to help someone feel more socially connected. You don't have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist to help bridge the loneliness gap. What you need is a heart full of compassion and the courage to be able to express that to others.
We're talking with Dr. Vivek Murthy. He's the former Surgeon General for the United States under President Barack Obama. We're talking about loneliness here. If you have questions for the doctor, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. When you would go up to Capitol Hill and talk about this, did you get members of Congress who would sometimes look at you when you talked about loneliness and kind of give you a strange look?
And it's funny you mentioned that. The answer is actually no. And this is one of the early signals to me of just how profoundly and expansively loneliness has impacted our population. Because while it was never raised proactively with me as an issue when I went to visit members of Congress or mayors or state legislators, whenever I would raise it, there was an immediate recognition that this was an issue. And for many people, it was actually a very personal recognition. They had often felt lonely themselves, even though in many cases they had never mentioned it to anyone. So what we have to recognize now is that lifting loneliness up as an issue that needs to be confronted and discussed is one of the most important things that we need to do, because we can't allow it to simmer under the surface, affecting millions and millions of people, having a profound impact on our health, education, and productivity, without being able to discuss this and talk about how to solve it.
You know, I'm struck by the fact that we're having this conversation just as the UK has announced its decision to appoint a minister for loneliness. I'm wondering, do we need one of those here in the US?
Well, I was glad to see the United Kingdom elevating the importance of the issue of loneliness. It's interesting, if you ask the question, who's in charge of addressing loneliness in the United States? Does it sit in a particular branch of government, in a particular part of the Department of Health and Human Services, or at the NIH? The answer is no one's really in charge of addressing it, because, again, it hasn't been seen as a critical public health issue. But you know what? It's not just the United Kingdom, but it's countries around the world that are starting to wake up to how much this is affecting their population. When I wrote an article in Harvard Business Review recently on loneliness in the workplace, and I was overwhelmed with the responses that I got from people all around the world who said, you know, this is something I have been experiencing personally that's affecting people in our workplace, that's affecting our children in school, and we don't know what to do with it. And these were countries, you know, like China and India and countries in the Middle East and in Europe and in Latin America. So this is not purely an American problem, but it is certainly profoundly affecting America, and that's why we have to figure out how we are going to deal with it.
We're talking about loneliness this morning on KCUR's Up to Date. You know, everybody gets lonely now and then, Doctor, but I'm wondering, at what point does it become a problem? I mean, how long do you have to be lonely for it to become an issue?
Well, I think it's worth stepping back and asking, what is loneliness to begin with? Because you're absolutely right that all of us feel lonely at some point in our lives. It's, in some ways, it's part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. The time when it gets concerning, though, is when you feel lonely for a prolonged period of time. Now, loneliness is a subjective state. So it's not about objectively how many friends do you have around you, or how many contacts or do you have, or conversations per day. It's a subjective feeling of having insufficient social connection in your life. And you could experience that if you have hundreds of friends around you, or you could only have one friend around you and still feel not alone at all. So what's important is to recognize that loneliness is a subjective feeling. And if you are feeling lonely, and if you continue to feel lonely for weeks and months on end, then that is a reason to be concerned. But it's important, again, to know that you are not alone. There's a great parallel here, actually, with the struggles that we are facing on the addiction front, with substance use and addiction.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah, and the issue of addiction is one that was one of my primary areas of focus when I was Surgeon General. And what I found is that there's a tremendous overlap here, that many families and individuals struggling with addiction are, in fact, also experiencing loneliness. Some of this is a result of the stigma around addiction. I remember visiting a family once in Oklahoma, a mother and father who had tragically lost their son to an opioid overdose. They'd experienced the worst pain that any parent should have to experience. And what they told me is that at every other juncture in their life, when they had hardship, neighbors would come over, they would bring food, they would sit with them, they would hold their hand. But when their son died, nobody came over because they were uncomfortable. They were good people, but they weren't sure what to say. They didn't know if coming over would somehow make the parents feel even more ashamed, even though the truth is they had nothing to be ashamed of. And so this family sat alone at one of the most painful moments in their life. And the sad reality is that there are millions of people like them struggling with addiction, the family members of people with addiction, who feel alone, who feel ostracized by their communities. And that sense of loneliness, it turns out, not only makes it harder for them to engage in treatment and to do what they need to do for their own health, but it contributes to an increased risk for other illnesses.
That's interesting. Let's go to some phone calls here for Dr. Vivek Murthy as we talk about loneliness. Kim from Overland Park, good morning.
Hi. I have 8-year-olds that, I'm finding out that there are kids as young as elementary age carrying smartphones.
Right.
Where they have access to social media and internet and things they really shouldn't be exposed to. And I would love to hear what you have to say about that and on the subject matter of loneliness, because I'm also aware of a lot of current research that's coming out about the effects of technology on children, especially ones that are being exposed to it too much and too early. And I know that in teens, the number one leading cause of death now in teens is suicide. And I just...
Right.
It's just very disturbing.
Dr. Murthy, what do we know about the connection between technology, smartphones, and loneliness?
Well, this is a really important question, and I really appreciate the question about children. You know, I think about this in personal terms. I'm a father myself. I have a 16-month-old son. I have a daughter who's on the way. And what I think about all the time is what kind of world are they going to grow up in? Mm-hmm. How do we ensure that they are not lonely, that they are connected? So I think that with technology, look, the truth is that we cannot wall children off from technology, nor should we. I think technology it's a tool, and it can be helpful when used in the right ways and the right circumstances. But the challenge with children is about how they use technology. So some of the research seems to suggest that when we use social media in a passive way, that it can actually increase our sense of loneliness and disconnection. So, for example, if I'm alone on a Friday night and I decide I'm going to go on social media and look through my friends' posts so that I can feel connected to them virtually, what actually ends up happening is I end up looking at idealized versions of their lives, and I end up feeling worse about my life, and I'm not actually having any real human connection. And when you imagine doing that again and again and again, multiple times a day, it can really create actually even a worse sense of self and a greater sense of isolation. What we need to help kids create is sacred time in their life where they are not on their phone, where they are not using technology, where they are, in fact, prioritizing time face-to-face with other people. Mm-hmm. And I would also say time with themselves. You know, we're talking about loneliness, and it's easy to think that the solution to loneliness is to enhance our connection with other people, and that is. But it turns out that being able to connect with other people is in part dependent on our ability to be able to connect with ourselves, to accept ourselves, to love ourselves. And far too many children, partly as a result of bullying, partly as a result of looking at idealized versions of other people's lives on social media, just have profound issues with self-esteem and with self-acceptance. And when you are feeling that you are not worthy, why would you think that anybody else would even want to connect with you?
Mm.
So we have to think about how we help build our children's sense of self, how we create sacred space for them to connect with other people. And one of the most powerful things you can do as a parent is to model that for them.
Well, it hurts for me to hear you say what you just said. It's such powerful stuff. You know, one question that people might have is, how do we know if someone is lonely or if they're just shy or introverted? Because not everyone wants to connect at the same pace as everybody else.
So that's absolutely true. And the desire to address loneliness is not the same as trying to make everyone an extrovert. I say this as someone who is myself an introvert, and my wife is an introvert too. But whether you're introverted or extroverted, all of us need some degree of meaningful social connection in our life. And the amount varies depending on our personality. And it's not always easy to know if people are lonely. This is something that people don't generally talk about. But you know, one of the things I have found to be helpful as a doctor, when I'm caring for patients, I began like later in my medical practice to start asking patients directly about how they were doing, about what kind of people they had in their lives. Did they spend time with other people? The UK found, for example, that when they looked at their seniors, that there were about 200,000 seniors in the UK who went a month or more without talking to a single family or friend. And, you know, that's really profound. And my guess is that that's not too different from what may be happening right here in the United States.
Let's go back to some calls and Dana from Lawrence. Dana, good morning. You're on KCUR's Up to Date. We're talking about loneliness.
Hi, thank you. This whole topic is really interesting from so many different facets.
Yes, it is.
I appreciate listening to what he just said. But one thing I've noticed, and I don't know if it's a trend, I don't consider myself a lonely person overall. You know, I do. You know, certainly everyone experiences bouts of loneliness here and there. But, you know, having moved from a situation from working in an office place where I constantly had people around me, and now there are so many employees, such as myself, who work remotely. And so, you know, you spend your whole day, you know, with people, you know, through email and some phone calls. But I'm just wondering, you know, for me, I know that it's just a different experience. There's some pros and cons about it, but I'm wondering, with the trend nationwide of more people having remote jobs, if possibly that's contributed to the higher number of loneliness as well.
That's an interesting question, Dana. Thanks for offering it. Doctor?
Dana, yeah, thank you for that question. And I think you hit on a really important issue that comes up all the time when I talk about this issue, which is, how does teleworking, working from remote, impact us? I don't think that teleworking is something that we should abolish. There's flexibility that telework gives us that can be really helpful, especially for people with young families. But we have to recognize that there are also risks that come that have to be managed with teleworking. And one of them is the increased challenge of ensuring that people have adequate connection with their work colleagues. There's some people I know who work from home, and they can go days and days and days without seeing or talking to a single person. They just work from their computer, and when they're done with work, they stay at home, and that's what they do. And that can be, I think, very dangerous for people. So we have to think about ways to engage people who are teleworking with face-to-face time with their colleagues, whether that's periodic visits, whether it's through video conferencing. And we also have to ensure that people who are teleworking are being especially vigilant about protecting their time with family and friends outside of work, mm-hmm. which is easier said than done, but absolutely essential. Look, the truth is, when you look at all of the data and the experiences that people are having around loneliness, when you look at the science that tells us how profoundly important loneliness is for our health, for our education, for our productivity in the workplace, you're left with one inescapable conclusion, and that's that we need each other. As much as we have a strain of individualism that runs so deeply in our country, we are truly interdependent creatures. Our greatest accomplishments as communities and our country are rarely the work of a single person. You know, it wasn't one person that put a man on the moon. It wasn't mm-hmm. one person that won World War II. These were acts of collective achievement that resulted from people working together, coming together, connecting with each other. And lastly, consider this. Many people in our country are worried about the state of dialogue in America. They're worried that we have lost our ability to talk to each other about difficult problems. They look at the news, they look at what's happening in politics, and they just see people screaming at each other all the time. And that's actually what happens when people are in chronic stress states, when they're disconnected from each other. Loneliness is, in fact, a chronic stress state. We were designed and we evolved actually to be social creatures that would optimize actually our survival thousands of years ago. And when we are disconnected from each other, our cortisol levels rise in a chronic stress state. We experience higher levels of inflammation. But we also very practically have a harder time actually coming together to solve difficult problems. Mm. In the face of adversity, we in fact retreat to our corners and throw stones at each other instead of coming together to figure out solutions and truly listen and understand each other. So connecting, helping to address loneliness, helping to build connection in America, it turns out, is not just good for our health. It's not just good for our education. It's not just good for our workplace. But it turns out to be one of the most patriotic and powerful things that we could do if we want to, in fact, improve dialogue and help our country come together to solve big problems.
Dr. Murthy, I'm just guessing here, you've got a book in you on this topic at some point.
Well, thank you. I will certainly take that advice.
I think it'd be a good one. That's Dr. Vivek Murthy. He's this country's former Surgeon General under President Barack Obama. Doctor, thanks so much for your time and your good thoughts on loneliness. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thanks for discussing this today. I appreciate it.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how white people can become better informed on race. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. Tomorrow on the show, our favorite film critics will be here. There's romance and mystery and true life events in the movies they'll review, and we'll chat about what might make the cut when Oscar nominations are announced next week. That's tomorrow's KCUR Up to Date. Well, one big roadblock to breaking down racism in America is this very simple idea that white people don't want to talk about it. As our guest today says, white people don't want to appear stupid, racist, or radical, so they just clam up. The result, an epidemic of silence from people who care deeply about all human beings, but who don't know how to help. Debbie Irving writes about all this in her new book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator and writer who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She joins us this morning from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Debbie, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And we want to thank listener Karen Orville for bringing our attention to Waking Up White. How did you get started on this crusade against racism, Debbie?
Well, you know, I grew up in a white suburb and went to a predominantly white college. So until the age of 22, I had a really steeped in white experience. And in my 20s, I started working in Boston in the nonprofit world, pulling together young students from various neighborhoods. And I ended up in neighborhoods that were disproportionately black and brown families and students and kids. And I couldn't help but notice that those neighborhoods looked a lot different than my white suburb, and that it, materially they were drastically different. And I couldn't figure this out. So I started getting signing up for diversity workshops and being on diversity committees. So I did that for 25 years and really felt there was an elephant in the room and I couldn't figure out what it was. It wasn't until the age of 48 when I went back to graduate school that a required course finally opened my eyes and gave me answers I'd been looking for but didn't understand what exactly I was looking for all those years. And it came in the form of most white people are trapped in a white history that we do not know what we're missing. We don't know the information. We don't know the racial discrimination of our country. In fact, many white people, as in my case, are taught that there's this level playing field, that America's a meritocracy. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just new information. When we start to learn about the real racial history imposed by white people on everybody else. But it's counter to everything I believed about myself and my country.
You know, this epidemic of silence that I mentioned in the introduction here that you write about so well in your book, you know, it makes sense to me that this exists because so many people, as you point out, don't want to say something wrong or hurtful or stupid. So what do you think is at the bottom of this epidemic of silence, and how do we break out of it? Because people are just scared to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, and on the other end of the spectrum, in terms of people who don't have the privilege of not talking about it, we've got families. Most people these days have heard about the talk that black and brown parents have to have with their children at a young age to help them understand how to stay safe if the police stop them. You know, how to not internalize some of the low expectations a teacher is going to put on them. Mm-hmm. So these are conversations that are early and often in black and brown households. And in white households, it's not happening. So there's already an elephant in the room as young, you know, happening in kindergarten, first, second grade, and when parents of different racial backgrounds are getting together in school environments, for instance. So part of the discomfort is at a deep level, you know, they say 90% of human interaction is not spoken. It's body language and all the kind of the vibe that we get. I think most white people understand that there's something very uncomfortable going on, and yet we don't have language, we don't have history, we don't understand what it is. And so the truth is we are likely to say something stupid. We are likely to step into it. The trick for me was learning that it's just about my ego. It's for me, my fear of saying something stupid is only about trying to save my own reputation, protect my own discomfort that I might feel if I make a mistake. But for people of color, historically, to speak his, her, their truth in order to educate white people, that risk is immense. You know, historically, it's meant death.
Mm-hmm.
And so one way we can actually level a playing field is for white people to really just embrace the idea of, I don't care if I look stupid or not. I need to learn this.
That's
and
interesting.
And I need to take some risks.
I just think as long as people feel that the road to healthy conversation is strewn with potholes, that we're never really going to get there.
And, you know, part of that is if I'm afraid that I can't recover if I step in a pothole, I'm less likely to take that risk.
Mm-hmm.
So once I start to realize, wait a minute, people make mistakes in relationships all the time. What matters is working through it. And becoming resilient in cross-racial settings is the key to being able to get in these conversations. And that is a resilience. You know, there's a term for what white people often do with one mess up, and it's called white fragility.
Mm-hmm.
Fragility as in the word fragile.
Right.
That white people are so fragile that they might not even, they might avoid conversations. And if something goes wrong, they'll defend themselves. They'll get angry and storm out. White women are known for crying, as opposed to saying, wait, I really want to understand what just happened.
And just hang in there, you're saying. Just hang in there with a conversation.
Yeah, and think of how every white person in the world knows how to do that in the context of your friendships and your family. I mean, who hasn't had a tough conversation when he, she, they were a teenager, or with your teenage child, or with your spouse? You know, relationships are tricky, and this is no different, but the weight of it is very different, and the breadth of the lack of understanding is just wider. So it's a bigger phenomenon, but it's a similar phenomenon.
I'm visiting with Debbie Irving. Her new book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race, it deals with how white people can deal with racism. You know, one impetus for this book is this realization you had, which is that white is a race in and of itself. Tell us about that moment that you experienced, because I'm guessing that there's a lot of people out there listening who could walk in your shoes as well.
Yeah, so I, you know, of course, when if you put a census in front of me, I knew to check off white. But I really, it turns out, down deep, I thought white was a kind of normal, and all other racial groups were some sort of a less than measurement from that.
Hmm.
And so another way to put that is I was thinking in terms of people in a hierarchical scheme, in a racial hierarchical scheme, and in my imagination, white people were at the top. Where on earth did that come from? Because nobody said that to me. But it turns out that that's the entire construct. That's the entire philosophy that the United States was founded on. It's the philosophy of white supremacy, which I'm not talking KKK when I use that term. I'm talking white people as supreme, as superior. And that's the philosophy that came from Europe to the United States in the founding and construction of this culture. And this government, and it's not just white. It's white, it's male, it's Anglo, it's Protestant, it's able-bodied, it's heteronormative. So there is a lot of normalization and a lot of this prototype of a human is more valuable as opposed to that other lesser-than type.
Put another way, your point is that a lot of white people think they're what? They're beyond race, right?
We're just all American. I'm just an American. Yeah. And that white is normal. And in fact, you know, the whole idea of race is a socially constructed phenomenon that began back in Europe but was really embedded here in the United States. The term white was first used in law in the United States. And it has been used to create a racial caste system that supports a socioeconomic class system. So when people get race and class confused, there's a good reason for that. It is deeply entangled, and it's not exactly the same. So that, you know, you can have poor white people for sure, impoverished white people. And this is way too much to try to explain in a short radio interview. I just hope that people will get curious if they're listening to this idea for
right.
the first time and wonder, what is she talking about? Because when I didn't get curious, I got afraid. When I felt someone was talking about something that was unfamiliar to me, my first place I went to was judgment or fear. I didn't get curious and say, I want to learn more about that.
Debbie Irving's new book, Waking Up White. You know, you talked about growing up believing that you owed it to the world to try to help people of color be more successful. You even at one point worked in inner city programs, and you said you tried to be all cheery and chirpy and helpful when you were on that job. But you learned two things: that you were being patronizing and black people resented you like crazy. Why was that?
Well, again, this goes back to history that is often well known in black and brown communities and not so much in white communities. It's called the white savior syndrome.
Right.
So I thought that if the playing field is level and my family seems to have achieved as much as it has, I'm a good person, so I'm not going to be mad and bigoted. I'm going to be helpful to those. Now, again, I'm going back to my internalized ideas. I'm going to be helpful to these poor people who down deep I've been taught are inferior. So a good person coming out of that mindset will, a quote-unquote good person, will seek to fix. But there's a horrible, a horrific, traumatic, violent, and long history just around the savior syndrome. One example is the Indian boarding schools, which is what the white government, the early government in the United States, created as they were stealing land and conquering Indian nations across the country. Children were taken from their families and put into quote-unquote boarding schools, where the point was to anglicize them and Christianize them.
Mm-hmm.
So they arrived hundreds of miles from their home, away from everything they knew. They had their hair cut. They had their clothing removed.
Mm-hmm.
They were scrubbed in a kerosene solution because they were considered dirty little savages. They were given Bibles and Christian names. And the idea there was to, quote, you know, it was to help and fix. And so when I think I'm going in to be helpful, I'm reminding people, and I am truly carrying with me, without even knowing it, all of that history of going in as a white woman to try to save the day.
So,
and when you think about...
So if that doesn't work, and you had such great intentions, Debbie, if that's not acceptable, what should you have been doing? Because that struck me as you were really making an effort way beyond the norm compared to most folks.
Right. And I had actually a lot of access to fundraising. It was easy for me to fundraise because I had access to funds because I was from a fairly wealthy Boston family with lots of connections. What I wish I had done now was spend a lot more time saying, can somebody help me understand what I'm seeing here?
Hmm.
Like I'm noticing the way neighborhoods look so different. Because I assumed that I knew more than people I'd been taught were inferior, when in fact, the very people I was trying to help and fix could have helped and fixed me. So if I had sat and asked, help me understand what I'm looking at, I would have been certainly taught about the history of redlining in our country. I would have been taught about the roots of white supremacist belief,
mm-hmm.
about race as a social construct, and maybe I would have taken that money and tried to educate white people or challenge the system or encourage foundations to give money to black and brown people who were the ones best equipped to solve their own issues.
But speaking of that, we just have about a minute left. You know, one of the keys you suggest in your book is to find ways to overcome our own ignorance, as you're suggesting here. But you say this: talking to African Americans about all this won't do the trick because they're exhausted from years spent trying to explain all this stuff. So who should white people talk to?
Well, I think it does need to be a combination. White people can't do anything in isolation very effectively. And yet there's a lot we can do to educate ourselves in white community and reading books, going on the internet. I have a quick and easy tool for people that I created with two colleagues, a black man and a white woman. It's called the 21-Day Racial Equity Challenge, and it lives on my website, which is debbieirving.com. Debbie's with a Y, Irving's with an I. And it gives people all kinds of ideas about what to do, from reading, what books, what articles, what podcasts to listen to, where to start looking on social media to connect with news outlets and activist educator groups. It's about both education and engagement. You can't do one without the other. So it's a multifaceted journey. And I encourage every white person to get on it because it's really unbelievable how much damage we white people can do when we're not aware of the history we carry inside ourselves.
Sorry we don't have more time for this segment because it's such a provocative set of ideas that Debbie has thrown out here. Debbie Irving's new book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. Debbie, thanks for the good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on, Steve.
Coming up next, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. KCR contributor Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend, and that sounds kind of interesting. What do we got?
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great.
Welcome back.
Welcome back to you as well. You were gone a little while, were
yes,
you
I
not?
Was. Yes, I was.
Yeah, okay. Well, two cellos.
Yes.
Are literally...
Playing two... fast.
Oh, yeah. But did you hear what happened there? Beethoven's Fifth Symphony... transmogrified into Led Zeppelin's Whole Lot of Love.
I noticed something's going on.
This is this is what they do. These are the virtuosic cellist guys, two, count them, two, who oh so cleverly combine classical music with classic pop rock. It's a 7 o'clock show Sunday night at Sprint Center. How about Michael Jackson's Smooth Criminal?
Huh.
They tackle it. They take it to the ground.
All the way.
But, I mean, these guys are classically trained, but they want to bring the old and the new together in a totally cool way. How about Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle?
Wow.
They'll do it. They do U2's With or Without You or and Where the Streets Have No Name. They do Viva La Vida. They out Coldplay Coldplay when it comes to orchestral shenanigans. You know, you think back, I guess the pop corollary for this would be ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra
right,
from the
right.
70s.
That's a good example.
Well, that
yeah.
was a fantastically executed gimmick by ELO leader Jeff Lynne. I mean, it was really inspirational. But it was still kind of a gimmick compared to what these guys do, which is, you know, they still do, you know, they work with the London Symphony Orchestra.
So they're legit.
They are. Thank you for that. Yes, you've done it again. But they'll also do Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit. Here's a good one. They do... Miser Lou, that was the 1960s surf guitar guru Dick Dale number. It was actually the theme from Pulp Fiction.
My goodness.
They do that too.
You've done
so,
your research.
Oh, well. Hey, they've done theirs, and you'll have a great time. Check it out. A kind of a different show, maybe a smaller show, Sunday at
Sunday
Sprint
Center. Sunday night at Sprint, yeah. My goodness, who are we talking about here?
Well, we know.
That's a dead giveaway.
We know.
Yeah.
Okay, what's your favorite Seinfeld episode?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, you have to remind me, but there's a bunch.
No, it's impossible.
Yeah.
How would you ever know? You know who's a big Seinfeld fan? Like the biggest one I know?
Who?
Tim Finn at the Star.
Oh, really?
I mean, he's like the one. I mean...
He knows them all.
Oh, he knows them all. He knows the ones that probably the pilot episode, the ones that were just thunk up by...
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, he's just really something. He's an
encyclopedia. We're talking about this because...
I wish Tim was here. He could go on and on. Yeah. Anyway, we're talking about this because Jerry Seinfeld, the star of the most non-mainstream, mainstream network television show ever
about
in the 90s.
Nothing.
The show supposedly about nothing, but was actually an innovative appreciation of, I don't know, crazy self-serving behavior as expressed through these ridiculously quirky friendships, alliances, vendettas on the show. Anyway, that was the show. But Jerry, the stand-up comic, the master, the perfectionist, right? He'll be here. Two shows
on the same night.
On the same night, because the first one at 7 o'clock Friday night at Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland sold out, but there are still tickets, I think, left for the 9:30 show Friday at the Midland. How about any thoughts on Master of Your Domain?
What do you mean?
Well, if Tim were... Well, it was the show called The Contest, my favorite episode.
Oh, get out of here.
Oh, well,
be sure to see Brian's six sophisticated things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
Ground control to Major Tom. 7, 6, commencing countdown, engines on.
What do we got here?
Well, we have a serious subject. This is a play called Defying Gravity. It's been around for quite a few years, but it was written, it was inspired by and addresses the 1986 Space Shuttle Challenger disaster.
Yeah.
And it is on stage this weekend. It's actually on stage tonight as well at the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater in Midtown. Probably the most famous person who passed away when the Challenger was tragically destroyed on that. Where were you when the Challenger blew up?
In the newsroom watching.
Me too.
It. Yeah.
Me
just,
too.
Just dumbstruck by what I was seeing.
That was really something. That was like a pre-9/11, not to say the wrong thing, but that was like a pre-9/11, 9/11. Anyway, here's a show. Krista McAuliffe, the late, great would-be teacher in space. She's kind of the MC for this loosely organized yet highly sophisticated play. And it really just comes down to asking the existential questions and thereby the implications of what, why are we here and where are we going?
Okay.
Whether it's space or the inner journey. Check it out, Metropolitan Ensemble Theater, Defying Gravity.
Where the ocean dances and the palm trees sweat, where the jellyfish glow and the mermaids play, where the sun glistens upon the sea, that's where I want to be.
What do we have here?
Okay, this is good. This is different. These are the Kansas City Bear Fighters. Kansas City Bear Fighters. I don't know if they actually wrestle deadly furry critters, but they are cool. They're a quirky local folk band, 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon at the Westport Saloon. They sound pretty sing-songy and friendly, do they not?
Mm-hmm.
Here's one of their tunes. Here's the tune we're listening to. It's called All Hail the Dark Lord, with lines like, where the shadows climb and the vultures perch, where children play in a burned-out church and the pools of blood flow to the sea. That's where I want to be. Anyway, I'm not sure I want to be there, but they're very sophisticated. They're very strange. Peek at their Facebook at your own risk. Saturday, 4 o'clock, Westport Saloon.
And finally today... What do we have here?
Makes me shake my head. Makes me sigh.
Yes.
Forever young. How young do you feel, Steve?
Not as young as I need to be to go to this event you're
going to
talk about.
Young enough, and neither am I, darn it, to attend the 2018 Party Arty, the Young Friends of Arts masquerade-themed mixer and fundraiser.
How young do you have to be?
Young.
Yeah.
20s.
20s?
Well, I mean, if you were 35, that's a big if, my friend. Hey, you could fake it. Who knows how many people will try to sneak in, but, you know.
They would throw me out.
Here's what you get. You get creative cocktails, you get abstract elements, and you get dim lighting. Now, what do you do with dim lighting when you're 25 years old at the Art Museum? I think you know.
You have fun.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's Brian McTavish and his weekend to-do list. And just to point out, Marcus Roberts, the great jazz pianist, 8 o'clock Friday night at the Folly. I'm interviewing him at 7 o'clock on stage.
Steve,
so come on
thank
over.
You for the cherry on top,
there you
pal.
Go.
That's beautiful.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, our film critics are here to talk about their latest picks and shed some light on what to expect when Oscar nominations are announced next week. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.